Thank you, Grant. Thank you guys in the audience for being here. And Paul, thank you for turning off the lights back there. That doesn't give you license to go asleep during my talk, though. I'm pleased to be on the program and probably more pleased to have one of the better experts here in working with the hypoxia issue in the Gulf of Mexico, Mark David, a friend and colleague at the University of Illinois that will follow me and correct all my mistakes in presentations. So there, that's my disclaimer, Mark. But no one shared the authorship on this presentation with me because I was last minute pulling it together. There's several in the Institute that could have worked with me and do work with me regularly. But the title of the presentation is as you see on the screen here. And I want to point out for many of you in the audience, I mean, just ask for a quick show of hands here. How many people are familiar with the hypoxia issue in the Gulf of Mexico? Most of the audience. I won't bore you to death with a lot of detail, but I didn't see a couple hands go up. But it is considered a natural event, which has been aggravated in more recent time, that's contributing to a reduction in dissolved oxygen, principally in the bottom waters of the shallow northern Gulf of Mexico. And it's a complex issue in that climate, weather, freshwater influence and stratification, nutrient discharge, coastal water circulation patterns, wind currents, wind direction and speed can influence the forcing of water and the development of hypoxia along the shallow coast of Louisiana. Prior to about 2006, there have been a number of conferences and presentations and proceedings, but in 2006, EPA's EPA Science Advisory Board impaneled a group of scientists to summarize and review and bring to kind of the state of the knowledge where we were with appreciation for the causes and effects of hypoxia in the Gulf of Mexico. And I mentioned Mark David. I don't know if Andrew Sharp is still in the audience or not. Andrew, the three of us were among this group you see pictured here as the panelists working on this effort. And that information fed into the 2008 hypoxia plan, which had called for an increased reduction in discharge of nitrogen and phosphorus from the previous 30% reduction in nitrogen to a 45% reduction in both nitrogen and phosphorus. Now, this is a 275-page report before the appendices, and not many of my friends and foes in the agricultural community would take that and read that and get very far in it. So we put together sort of a synoptic outlook of what we consider some of the take-home messages with respect to nutrient management in our Better Crops publication that comes out quarterly. And I'm going to pull from some of that information here in some of the slides a little bit later. But many of you maybe have watched this pattern of the size of the hypoxic zone come and go over the years. There's a lot of year-to-year variation. In 1989, there was no measure, and the green arrows depict those years in which the influence of hurricanes impaired the ability to accurately measure the full extent of the hypoxic zone, according to Dr. Rabelais. And of course, we would like to be down around 5,000 square kilometers to restore the health in the ecology of the system. Unfortunately, what previously was thought to be a good predictor of the size of the hypoxic zone from what we knew, and I'll go over that again in just a little bit, did a poor job at predicting the size of the hypoxic zone in 2009. Gene Turner and Nancy thought this would be probably second or third highest size of the zone, and as you see, it was closer to the 5,000 target level in 2009 than what was first anticipated. Well, Don Scavia and others with the NOAA National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration had done some modeling to predict the size of the hypoxic zone to be able to define what kind of load reduction might be needed to achieve this 5,000 square kilometer area. And they used May to June total nitrogen loads from 1985 to 2002 and hindcast to 1972. And since then, there have been a few other papers, including Gene Turner's in 2006, using 1985 to 2004 data and hindcasting to 78, identifying May as perhaps one of the key months in the spring during which the load could be used to predict the size of the hypoxic zone. And you see here for nitrate, nitrogen, and total nitrogen, the R-square values there, explaining that much variability in the size of the hypoxic zone. But you'll also notice that the orthophosphate and total P actually had the higher R-square compared to these two nitrogen forms. Now, there was an increase in residual air over time that Dr. Turner attributes to a memory effect in the system. So he believed by plugging in a year into his regression model that he could better predict, and indeed his R-square value rose from the 0.5 level up to the 0.82 level with a recognition of that memory effect in the system, if you will. Campbell and Booth looked at this nitrate flux to the Gulf of Mexico, and in their report, they made this statement that sometimes is a little confusing to me because I don't think we've exactly identified the specific source of nitrogen from our agricultural systems. There's no doubt that fertilizer and nitrogen contributes to it, but I think sometimes when people say fertilizer runoff, they mean direct fertilizer runoff, and I don't think that we can really make this statement that broadly, although there's no question fertilizer and nitrogen does contribute. Well, this regression approach went from 1990 to 2002 with the Sparrow spatially referenced regression on watershed attributes model used a March to June nitrate loading to the Gulf, in which fertilizer nitrogen runoff was attributed as having 59% of the contribution of that runoff, with atmospheric deposition contributing 17%, animal waste 13%, and municipal waste 11%. Well, using the March through June modeled approach here with Sparrow, 65% of the size of the hypoxic zone annually could be explained by that discharge of nitrate in March through June, but when the April to July delivery was considered, the R-square rose to 0.86. Now, I'm not going to beat you to death a lot of this review, but I do think it's important to acknowledge the work that preceded this presentation today. But this work has continued, and Rick Green with EPA went through a perhaps a more rigorous approach, regression modeling approach, using this adjusted maximum likelihood estimation from the USGS data and this composite method. The composite method allowed for a change in the intercept in the slope of the curves after 1993. And he believed the system changed in 1993 that necessitated that. But he used these various concentrations and flows to predict the size of the hypoxic zone. And his best prediction occurred there with the 0.8 R-square, as you see, was including May stream flow plus May nitrate plus nitrite concentration, plus inclusion of the February total phosphorus concentration using this EPIC model, which allowed a change in the intercept, the regression model. But what all this amounts to is that if we could predict tomorrow what a 50% reduction in flow, 50% reduction in load of nitrate nitrogen would do to the size of the hypoxic zone in the Gulf, Dr. Green felt it would take 5 years to begin to detect that. And of course, if we have a slower reduction rate in delivery to the Gulf, it's going to take longer. So if we take 10 years to ratchet down this discharge, it could take 10 years to see a response after we achieve that target in discharge. Well, my purpose of this presentation today is kind of bring us up to speed, and I was out of curiosity wanting to look and see what's happened since 2004. And using 1985 to 2009 data, nutrient flux annual spring, which is April to June for this case, and then May, and then the spring and annual nutrient flux to the Gulf, and the relationship to fertilizer, nitrogen, or phosphorus consumption within the Mississippi Atchafalaya River Basin, harvested corn and soybean area in the Mississippi Atchafalaya River Basin. And these are the data sources that we relied on to look at these numbers and the relationships. And then we'll also discuss some of these recent nutrient flux trends and balances that were included in the hypoxia SAB report. Well, very quickly, just wanted to point out the top chart here shows annual stream flow from 1980 to 2009, and then the 2008, and then the spring stream flow from 1980 to 2009. And what you see is there's really no slope to that trend line. It's relatively flat. So that says stream flow has remained relatively constant with the year-to-year variation, but no real pattern over time. If we look at the total nitrogen and nitrate-nitrogen discharge, what you see is the nitrate-nitrogen has remained flat, while total nitrogen has declined to some extent over that same time period. For orthophosphorus, it has increased slightly, while total phosphorus has increased roughly 12%. Over this time period. Well, what about the relationship between fertilizer nitrogen and corn acres? Of course, what we know is the more corn you produce, the more fertilizer farmers use, and this relationship between corn acreage and fertilizer nitrogen consumption in the basin is relatively strong with an R-square of 0.61. But you'll notice that the fertilizer phosphorus consumption has been pretty constant from about 1984 to current. We looked at this relationship between the harvested corn and soybean hectares in the Mississippi Basin from 1985 to 2008, and you see that this R-square value here is relatively low, but it is statistically significant for corn versus the hypoxic zone, and summing the acreage in corn and soybeans increased the R-square somewhat, but the significance still fairly high too. Well, the size of the corn and soybean hectares doesn't really matter unless it's the nutrients that are leaving there that are perhaps impacting the Gulf. Remotely, they can't affect that. So what is the mechanism by which that happens? Well, we think nutrient loss. But if we look at the size of the hypoxic zone explained by spring nitrate, which is, again, March, April, June, the R-square is 0.26 for this time period, not nearly as high as some of the previous studies had indicated using different time periods. And for spring orthophosphate, it was 0.27. When you combine spring nitrate and ortho-P in the linear regression model, the R-square goes to 0.25, but each of these was statistically significant except for annual total nitrogen loss. But if we move to Mayflux, and you see, according to Dr. Turner's work, Mayflux alone seemed to be able to explain a greater portion of the variation in the size of the hypoxic zone. And indeed, the R-square for this total time period, 85 to 2009, actually did increase slightly. How much of the spring nitrate and orthophosphate flux could be represented just strictly by an increase in the size of the corn and soybean hectares? And what you see is a fairly low R-square here for each of these relationships, and no statistical significance bordering on it here, with the spring orthoflux being somewhat explained by corn hectares. I was a little surprised by this, frankly. How much of this flux of nutrients is explained by fertilizer nitrogen phosphorus consumption in the basin? And I was also a little surprised to see that this R-square value is really fairly low. 12% of the variation in spring orthophosphate flux is explained by fertilizer P consumption, with a significance at the 6% level. What we've seen, based upon the 1980 to 96 contrast with 2001 to 2005, as was reported in the Hypoxia SAB report in 2008, is that annual and spring nitrate nitrogen discharges and total nitrogen declined from the more recent period contrasted with the prior period. That's a good indication. Much of this discharge of these nutrients is coming from the two upper basin areas, the upper Mississippi Basin and the Ohio-Tennessee Basin, which account for about 16% of the land area, but 60 to 84% of the nutrient discharge. The USGS Sparrow model has looked at the loss of nutrients within these watersheds throughout the basin and their delivery to the Gulf, and you can see that in some cases we're exceeding 10 kilograms per hectare in delivery to the Gulf from some of these regions, and greater than 1 kilogram of P per hectare. So we have some challenges in addressing these losses. And of course, the form of these losses may have something, we may need to understand the form of these losses to understand where we need to go in and implement different management strategies to reduce those losses. I would point out that even though I live in Arkansas in the lower Mississippi Basin, I don't want to point the finger too hard at my neighbors up north, because we have our own challenges with total phosphorus loss from the lower basin. We think it's largely due to sheet and erosion from some of our clay fields that have a relatively high native P content. Well, we've looked at these nutrient balances, and actually Mark David, who's one of the scientists, has contributed to these reports that are cited here on the right-hand side in this blue box, and if I can get the mouse to work right. And this net input was determined for these basin areas by including fertilizer and atmospheric deposition into fix with soybeans and other legumes, minus the net feed and food imports, which includes, that really takes into account the manure contribution. And what this shows is across the entire Mississippi Basin, the balance here is above zero. So there's a net surplus of N in the system, which means it could be prone to some loss. But in the Ohio and the upper Mississippi Basin, this ratio, this net input balance, is actually declining, such that we see some positive indication that we are having some benefits there, some impacts on reducing this loss relative to what we're seeing with the 19 to 21% decline. Net phosphorus trends, we see something very similar. We've gone below zero. Soil P may be mined, actually, in some of these areas, and that causes me some concern, because we know if we neglect phosphorus nutrition, there is a chance that it can impair nitrogen use efficiency in some systems. So just summarizing very quickly here is harvested corn and soybean only had a weak relationship to hypoxia in the Gulf, no significant relationship to N and P flux to the Gulf. And this spring flux, R-square was 0.26 to 0.36 for May for May nitrate flux, and April to June flux of nitrate and ortho-P. Nutrient loss has declined from 2001 to 2005 compared to the previous period, 80 to 96. And in the NNP consumption, only ortho P flux was weakly related to fertilizer P with an R-square of 0.12, but no other significant relationships were found. We have some challenges, and am I totally out of time now, Grant?
Yeah,
I got a minute.
About a half minute.
Okay, I'll wrap it up. We have some major challenges in that we know nitrogen use efficiency is not as good as it could be with better and improved management of nutrients in the system. And without going into the rest of the slides, I'll just say that our industry has embarked on the 4R nutrient stewardship approach, using the right source at the right rate at the right time in the right place. And of course, that's very dependent upon ongoing research to know what is right in a given locale. And we need to make sure that that is very site-specific and sensitive. And with that, I'll stop. If there's any time for one question or so, I'll take it, Grant.
Let's,